White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to our program tonight. It is Thursday, March 28, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hadding Scott.
Tonight's episode is very good, I think. I've been saying that, Hadding, most every week, but, you know, I'm not just saying it, but it's to say it, but, I mean, it's really true. I think tonight's very good. And one thing I wanted to mention last week was that there was something in last week's chapter and also in this chapter, but I didn't look for it. It's fairly close to the beginning, I think, where the writing indicates that they don't believe the Jews' story about their history. And as we know, one of these writers, was it Cameron, the main writer who was, he's not Christian. I don't know that he was Christian identity. He was British Israel for a while. Maybe. Mm. Maybe he called himself that, but he's into this. And he brings it out in the, you know, a few times. When we get to it, I'm going to mention it. But I didn't mention it last week because, probably because I don't know, but maybe because I knew we didn't have that much time by the time we got to it. And we just finished last week. So this one is not quite as long as last week, so we won't have any trouble finishing it. And I wanted to point that out to people. You didn't notice that about what they say about the Jews?
Oh, yeah. He says that the Jews are not the people of the Old Testament.
Yes. Yeah. That's what he said.
And, I mean, there are a lot of people that would say that without necessarily being Christian identity.
Okay.
There's this Jew, Shlomo Sand, who says that. He says that the Jews are a religious group that are masquerading as a nationality.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I read his stuff. Yeah, he's an archaeologist, isn't he? Or is he just looking at the archaeology?
I'm not sure. Not sure what is.
That's right. I think you're right. I think he might not be an archaeologist. But there's archaeologists that have been working down there and saying that none of this stuff exists. But then there's not only, anti-Bible people, let's say, but also Christian identity people don't like that because they say all that stuff did exist, although it wasn't Jews, you know, so they, you know, it's...
I mean, you're mingling two different questions. The question of whether the Jews are an ethnic group, you know, a genuine biological population that has some homogeneity and common ancestry, that's one question. And a completely separate question is whether the Old Testament can be taken seriously as history. And there's pretty strong evidence that it should not be.
Yeah, but the people who do are really against that, and they say they can show otherwise. I'm glad I don't have to be in that argument. You know, that's tough, and when you get into things like that,
there's that third question, of course, which is whether the Old Testament is real history or not. If you should say that these Jews are the people that starred in it, and that would be the concern of the Christian identity people, they'd say, it's a true history, but the Jews are not the
right
people in it.
Well, whether it is or not, I don't think that the Jews are the people of it. I don't think the Jews are what they say they are.
Well, it's not a real history anyway. All right.
Well, I didn't mean to bring that out. Okay. Let's get started with chapter 36, Jewish Rights to Put Studies Out of Schools. It's actually more interesting than it sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. The organizations of Jewry are numerous and widespread, all of them being international in tone, whether so chartered or not. The Alliance Israélite Universelle is perhaps the world clearinghouse of Jewish policy, with which every national aggregation of Jewish societies has affiliation. the independent order of B'nai B'rith, which is now hopeful of reaching the 1 million membership mark, is frankly international. It has divided the world into 11 districts, 7 of which are in the United States. Its lodges at last report numbered 426. The 4 members of its executive committee who do not reside in the United States reside in Berlin, Vienna, Bucharest, and Constantinople, respectively. Its lodges have been set up in the United States, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Henry Morgenthau's name appears in the 1919-1920 Jewish Yearbook as a member of this executive committee. Mr. Morgenthau will be remembered as the American minister to Turkey, later talked of as ambassador to Mexico, then chosen by President Wilson to mediate between the Turks and the Armenians. Mr. Morgenthau also investigated for the president the reports of the Polish pogroms.
You know, this Morgenthau is the father of the one we're more familiar with, which is Henry Morgenthau Jr.
Yeah, Hans Morgenthau. Who was?
Yeah. Huh? What?
Yes.
Okay, this one's name is his name is Henry. They're both Henry. The other, the younger Henry was Henry Jr. And he worked for Roosevelt, isn't that right?
Yes, I believe he was the Secretary of Treasury, wasn't he?
Yeah, Secretary of the Treasury, right. And the Morgenthau plan, but this was his father. So that, you know, he comes from a family that was in like Flynn with our political leaders. This one worked with President Wilson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Worked for the Jews.
Mm-hmm. And being sent to, what was it say? He was like a minister to Turkey. That was an interesting place for a Zionist Jew to be assigned because Palestine at that time belonged to Turkey.
That was pretty important at that time, what was going on there. And there was a lot of activity,
I mean,
a lot of political importance to what was going on there because it was still the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And
the First World War, I believe, was already going on when Morgenthau was the minister to Turkey.
Yeah, and you know, my knowledge of that period in that area is very poor, and I tend to get it mixed up and say things, you know, that aren't quite right. I should spend some time studying it, but it's hard.
He wrote a book about the problems between the Turks and Armenians that Armenians like to cite as a source for very high claims of Turkish murders of Armenians.
So he, even though he's minister to Turkey, he was on the Armenian side?
It appears that way.
Favored them?
Well, okay. This is the way I like to look at this. I don't have anything against Armenians, but I do think that Morgenthau exaggerated the Turkish atrocities because he wanted Palestine.
Yeah.
That's the way I see that.
I think the Turkish atrocities have been exaggerated too, even though,
right.
Again, you know, okay. Let's go.
All right. In studying the executive committees of Jewish societies, it is strikingly evident that the same minds guide all the important ones. A few names recur again and again. They are the names one meets at all Senate hearings, at various strategic places in the war government of the United States, and at every stage of Jewish interference with American foreign policy. Everything centers, at last, apparently, in the American Jewish Committee and the Executive Committee of the New York Kehila. Judge Mack, Judge Brandeis, the Warburgs, the Schiffs, Morgenthau, Wolf, Krauss, Elkes, Strauss, Louis Marshall, all these names appear over and over again in offensive and defensive action in all big affairs.
Well, that pretty much tells us in a sense there that there is a leadership that is doing all this, and this adds to the conspiracy theory theories, you know, the conspiracy idea heading, because you do have these big Jews who are behind, they say here, all these different committees. Wherever you look, there's these same names.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
There are now in the United States 6,100 reported Jewish organizations. Of these, 3,637 are in New York City. This figure is offered from the 1919-1920 yearbook, although the statement was recently made that the New York Kehillah is the clearinghouse of 4,000 organizations. Enough is shown to indicate how fully organized the Jews are, how they are linked together by every conceivable bond, the material of every bond being their racial likeness. The organization about which the public has heard most is the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith. Its headquarters are not in New York, strange to say, but in Chicago. Its origin, however, as might be expected, was in New York. This interesting order, without a reference to which no survey of Jewry is complete, came into existence in the back room of an Essex Street saloon in 1843. Strange enough, its most moving spirit at the beginning was a Henry Jones, although his colleagues retained their Hebraic names.
Well, it sounds a lot like the National Socialist Party. I mean, here this B'nai B'rith was also started in a saloon. You know, I mean,
that's where people get together, I suppose.
That's right. That's all that they were doing in the NSDAP. They tended to meet together in these beer halls. And here they meet in saloons in New York.
Because most of the founders were from Germany, the name was given in German, Bundesbrüder, which is in Hebrew, B'nai B'rit, Brothers of the Covenant. The executive committee was known as the Elders. The order spread first to Cincinnati, apparently taking the course of German immigration through the country, and it is recorded that the second lodge in that city is the first where the English language was used in discussing lodge affairs. The first leap of the order abroad was to Berlin, where in 1885 Grand Lodge No. 8 was installed, followed soon after by Grand Lodges in Romania and Austria. The order's literature lays stress on the work of inculcating patriotism, which is said to be one of B'nai B'rith's special interests. It is perhaps not meant, however, that the head office at Chicago could undertake, especially during recent years, to guide the patriotism of all the districts throughout the world. It would have been rather awkward for District No. 6, which includes Illinois, to encourage District No. 8 to loyalty, seeing that District No. 8 embraced Germany.
Oh, they must mean patriotism to their own selves, right?
Well,
Jewish patriotism.
It kind of looks like a fig leaf for the fact that they're really ethnocentric Jews pursuing an interest that's opposed to that of whatever nation they inhabit. So what they do is they emphasize inculcating the appearance of patriotism, I would say.
Yeah, well, that's probably it. But then I thought, well, maybe, you know, it was really meant Jewish patriotism, but you're probably right.
The order has not avoided the political field. The diplomatic history of the United States in the last 70 years is dotted all over with indications of B'nai B'rith activities. Oscar Strauss, writing from the legation of the United States at Constantinople in 1889, tells Secretary of State Blaine that the Jerusalem Lodge of B'nai B'rith at Jerusalem was quite satisfied with the way in which the State Department had attended to a certain matter at the lodge's request. Mr. Morgenthau, in the midst of his investigation of the false pogrom rumors in Poland, goes to B'nai B'rith Lodge. In 1870, Brother Benjamin F. Piexotto was appointed as, quote, as United States consul at Bucharest for the express purpose of securing an amelioration of the condition of the shockingly persecuted Jews in Romania, close quote. The persecution in Romania was the protest of the Romanian peasantry against the two greatest menaces to the peasant farmers, the Jew-controlled liquor and mortgage traffics.
Yeah, now this is real important, I think, for people to take note of, that here they're talking about pogroms, and here they've got this Henry Morgenthau investigating these rumors, and they're making all this big noise about it, and they're appointing United States consuls to go there and look into it. And it's all about Romanian peasants who are protesting against Jews.
Yep.
You know, it's just so typical. You know, and do people learn about that? No. I would say they probably didn't. They probably were pushing this in the papers at the time and totally misrepresenting what was really happening.
But this special appointment was made, quote, in pursuance of suggestions made by the order. And the negotiations were carried on chiefly by Brother Simon Wolfe, close quote. Simon Wolfe has been the official Jewish lobbyist at Washington on fixed post for 50 years. He could write an informative story of the relation of B'nai B'rith to diplomatic appointments if he would. It was he who suggested to William Jennings Bryan, when the latter was Secretary of State, that a Jew be appointed minister to Spain, to show Spain that the United States did not approve Spain's act of expulsion back in the 15th century. Jews are also suggested to President Harding, suggesting to President Harding that a Jew be appointed ambassador to Germany to rebuke the Germans' resentment against Jewish control of finance, industry, and politics.
This is really chutzpah, right? These people? Good grief.
Yeah. Well, you know, that really brings to life that saying, never forget, right? Yeah. They expelled Jews from Spain 1492. And
they haven't forgotten.
You know, 400 years later, they're asking the United States government to do something to insult the Spaniards over it.
Right. You know, right. Just there's something else.
This conception of the United States diplomatic service as a convenient agency for the transaction of Jewish world affairs has been in existence a long time and has accounted for some of the strange appointments which have puzzled the people. And that's why we're in Middle East wars right now. It is worth noting that while American Jews are crowding the eastern diplomatic posts with as many Jews as possible, British Jews are doing the same thing in the Judaization of the Persia, India, and Palestine governments, so that the whole Mid-Orient is now under Jewish control, and the Mohammedan world is given to understand that the Jews are merely coming back from their conquest of the white races. To those who have observed the Jewish attempt to seek a rapprochement between the followers of Moses and Muhammad, the situation is one of the keenest interest.
Aha! See, they're always doing that. They're playing off, they play together with the Arabs and the other Semites, and then they try to play together with the, the white people.
Divide and rule.
Yeah.
The B'nai B'rith is made up mostly of the more liberal Jews, religiously speaking, and doubtless includes a large number who are also liberal, racially speaking. I guess he means that they're not entirely of Jewish stock.
He thinks that they think that they're not so earnestly Jewish as other Jewish groups.
Perhaps.
That's the way I take it.
The time when it stood as spokesman of Jewish ideals is now long past. It stands today the center of certain Jewish activities. It does not supersede the American Jewish Committee by any means, but it is the encircling arm, with fingers everywhere, through which the committee can get its will carried out. When there is anything to be done, the B'nai B'rith is the organization which takes the lead in putting it over. It may be described as a Freemasonry exclusively for Jews. This brings up another characteristic that people have noticed and discussed. The Jew demands as his right entrance into other orders. Into his own he admits none but Jews. This one-sided policy is found everywhere.
Well, now, my comment here is that this is something we should carve in stone. This is one of the true statements, one of the basic things that we need to know about Jews and to repeat about Jews and to notice that they always have done it and they're still doing it. You know, they're so, I guess they don't care how they look, but they just, demand that they get into everything that, that other people would like to keep them out of, but they don't let, they have all this stuff that is just for them and nobody does that to them. You know, yeah. Nobody's demanding to get into it because see, the other people don't want to, and we don't do things just for, phony reasons like they do, or something like that. How else do you explain it?
Chief among the B'nai B'rith's activities, insofar as they directly relate to the rest of the people, is the work of the Anti-Defamation League. This inside committee in every lodge attends to the espionage work necessary to keep the Grand Lodge informed as to what is going on with reference to Jewry in the United States. In its work, the Anti-Defamation League always takes the offensive and works along pretty well-defined lines. Got it. Lost my page here.
Oh.
Okay. Ordinarily, the head of the Anti-Defamation League in each city is a man competent to bring pressure to bear on the public press. Sometimes he is the head of an advertising agency, which, as a rule, pools the Jewish department store advertising of that city so that the newspapers may be controlled from that angle. Sometimes he is himself a heavy advertiser, pledged the cooperation of other advertisers in whatever he undertakes to do. The Anti-Defamation League is the instrument through which all boycotting tactics make their appearance. This league not only makes its protests from without, but directs reprisals from within. It is an exceedingly militant body and does not always depend upon the rule of reason in its activities.
It's all very interesting. So, you know, I guess Abe Foxman stays the head of that as long as he has because he's very militant and they don't care how idiotic he looks as long as he keeps, you know, up that kind of pressure all the time. That's his job.
Yeah. Well, what it shows there is that Jews don't need to own every media outlet in order to exert a powerful influence over each one because they have businesses and they'll withdraw their advertising. They have no compunction about it. They don't respect the free flow of information enough to refrain from doing that, so they do it very brazenly.
You know, your sound, your voice is getting is kind of distorted, off and on. And I don't know though that if the listeners are hearing it or not. I guess I sound all right to you. You haven't said anything,
okay.
But we'll just go ahead because there's nothing to do about it. And you know, it's something in
right.
The Skype. Yeah.
Well, I'll turn off my antivirus, and that might help.
Oh, okay.
All right. Okay. Many quaint tales could be told of the operations of the Anti-Defamation League in various American cities, But as the present articles attempt to give no more than a bird's eye view of widespread Jewish activities, mere storytelling will have to wait. But perhaps the most notable accomplishment of the League has been the suppression of the word Jew in the public prints in any of but the most laudatory connections. For a long time in the United States, the people did not know how to refer to the Jews, whether as Hebrews or Israelites or what, because the fear of giving offense had been so diligently cultivated in all quarters.
Now, that is one of my favorite sentences there, and I use that in this article that I just posted yesterday evening that at the White Network and also on my Carolyn Yeager website. And its title is, Thoughts on the Jewish Problem and the Holocaust. And so I would encourage people to look for that. But anyway, I quoted this in there because it fits so well. I just love it. It's the fear of giving offense, you know. That's what they've instilled and how well they put that, that people don't, again, you know, they don't know what to call them because no matter what you do, they're gonna take offense at it.
Yeah.
Disgusting. So true.
Fear of the Jews.
Yeah.
The result was that other nationalities were laden with all the undesirable publicity which the Jews had evaded through the efforts of the Anti-Defamation League. Recently, a Jew was on trial for the murder of his wife. The newspapers referred to him as a pert little Englishman. The Russians in the United States and the Poles also have been filled with indignation by the extent to which their national names have been used in police and newspaper reports to conceal the identity of Jews. The Russians resident in this country have several times been compelled to remonstrate with the press for its misrepresentative practice in this matter.
You know, I had to read that a couple times before I got through my denseness, what they were talking about. That they were calling people, the newspapers are calling criminals, Russians and Poles and so on, rather than Jews, and they don't like it.
Yeah.
The
Russians and Poles don't like it.
Right.
For this state of affairs, the Anti-Defamation League receives the credit. Whenever a newspaper printed the word Jew as an identifying noun after the name of anyone who had been discredited, the Anti-Defamation League was instantly on the job in protest. The stock argument is, if he had been a Baptist or an Episcopalian, you would not have told it. And why should you say that he is a Jew? Jew being a mere religious denomination. City editors are obliging, and the rule became established. In principle, it is right, although it is urged on wrong grounds. But in practice, it has turned out to be a great injustice to other nationalities, and more than all, it has curtailed the freedom of American speech. It has concealed the Jew where he most wishes to be concealed. And it cannot be said that he has made the best use of this privilege. It is this fixed policy of the B'nai B'rith's Anti-Defamation League which imperils the hope that the B'nai B'rith might have come to the front as one of the most useful influences in the solution of the Jewish question. It includes a body of men sufficiently acquainted with the general point of view to be able to see where corrections and concessions are necessary as a ground, not to mere polite tolerance, but to reconciliation. There is no country in the world more propitious for the settlement of the world's Jewish problem than is the United States, but it cannot be settled along the old lines of the Judaization of the United States, nor by its de-Christianization either. The work of the Anti-Defamation League is positive to Judaization, and negative to settlement. There is nothing that Jewry, acting through the B'nai B'rith, does so well as to hold mass meetings and attack the Merchant of Venice.
Oh, that's their favorite thing, is to go after the Merchant of Venice.
Yeah.
That's a riot.
They're very talented at that, apparently. Mass meetings may be described as the Jews' great American pastime. The New York Kehillah, that is, the American Jewish Committee, can on one day's notice organize mass meetings in every city in the United States. They are mechanical devices, of course. They are not so much expressions of the Jewish mind as they are attempts to impress the non-Jewish mind. There is a great deal of theatrical calculation in them. This column could be filled with the dates and places of mass meetings held within any 7 days on any question in which the Jews had decided to coerce or accelerate public, or as it is usually called, or as it usually is, official opinion. The mass meeting, it appears, can still be made to seem real to the political official whose vote is sought. So it's a big...
Big farce. So people go to all these mass meetings, and they think they're really participating and they're important, and they're just set up in order to make them feel that way.
Yeah. It was by mass meetings that Congress was coerced into breaking off our commercial treaty with Russia. That means while the Tsar was in control. It was by mass meetings that the literacy test was defeated. It means for immigrants. It was by mass meetings that every attempt to restrict immigration has been defeated. In 100 important cities, a mass meeting could be held tomorrow night if President Harding should attempt to remove a Jewish official, or if the Census Bureau should attempt to record Jews under the proper racial name. It is a very perfect system, even if a little antiquated. Doubtless, its main purpose is to let the Jewish masses believe they too have something to say in Jewish affairs. Jewish leadership of the Jews is never quite what the Jews think it is, and its weakness was never more apparent than today. There has not been any persecution of the Jews in the United States, and never will be any. But all that the Jews have had to carry in the way of misunderstanding has been the result of the leadership which has misled them into paths of bloated ambition instead of a substantial human achievement. At this moment there is trembling, not among the Jewish masses, but among their leaders. The Jewish people will presently take their own affairs in their own hands, and then their affairs will go better. There are too many committees, too many prophets, too many wise men, who think that 2 minutes with a president constitutes greatness, and that a busy bustling overseas and back constitutes statesmanship. The Jews have suffered from the personal ambitions and pathetic incapacity of some of their most advertised men.
Well, they're hopeful that the Jewish people, something's going to happen with these Jews. And, you know, it never did, though, did it? What do you think?
Well, I think when Jews drift away from the Jewish leadership, they tend to just assimilate. They disappear from Jewry. I think that's
Well, that's what they want to stop. That's what they don't want to happen.
Yeah.
But I think that's right.
So I mean,
but there's not enough of them that do that. How many do that? You can't find very many.
Oh, well, there are some.
Yeah, but how?
There are some. There are a lot of secular Jews out there, and secular Jews, for one thing, they tend not to have very many children, and a lot of them do intermarry.
Well, like Stuart, we have our friend Stuart, who it turns out he's a Jew. Did you listen to that show?
Yes,
with
I
Dan
did.
And Yeah, that was a surprise to me. He's such a nice guy, but there he is. What are you going to?
And you had that quarter Jewish woman, Patty.
Yeah, the woman Patty. Yes.
Yeah. The B'nai B'rith has this much in its favor. Its leadership has always been progressive. Only when it has lent itself as a local agent for the leaders of the New York Kehillah has it set up in its neighborhoods those influences which tend toward division instead of a better understanding. Under whose inspiration it was that the B'nai B'rith undertook to bring its great power to bear against one of Shakespeare's plays cannot now be said, but it has been most unfortunate for Jewish influence in all directions. Successful, oh yes, but such a success as serious people could well do without. Merely to glance over the record is interesting. 1907, Jews force the Merchant of Venice to be dropped from public schools in Galveston, Texas, Cleveland, Ohio, El Paso, Texas, Youngstown, Ohio. 1908. Jews have the Merchant of Venice eliminated from the English course in the high school at El Paso, Texas. 1910. Apparently the merchant slipped back into Cleveland schools, for in April the superintendent of public schools issued an order that it was not to be used again. 1911, Rabbi Harry W. Ettleston and Solomon Elsner request the Hartford, Connecticut School Board to have the Merchant of Venice dropped from the reading list of their schools. The board complies. 1912, Jewish residents of Minneapolis, Minnesota inaugurate a movement to have the Merchant of Venice dropped from the public schools. In Boston, Massachusetts, the superintendent of schools refuses to withdraw the Merchant of Venice as a textbook on the demand of Rabbi Phineas Israeli. 1916, on demand of Jews, the New Haven, Connecticut's Board of Education votes to prevent the reading of the Merchant of Venice and extends the prohibition to Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare until an edition is published which omits the play. Wowie zowie. A lot of stuff you won't find on library shelves for similar reasons.
Yeah, and like you won't find revisionist or Holocaust revisionist books either. But that's a different deal.
And so on down the list of cities, a diversion was created by the Jewish attack on Sargent's painting entitled The Synagogue in the art scheme of the Boston Public Library. Many denunciatory resolutions were adopted throughout the country with regard to that, but the painting is still there.
Yeah, we had that in a show, one of these shows before, and used that as the artwork for it, I recall. That was the one where they had he painted Sargent without thinking there was anything wrong with it either. He painted the synagogue, a figure that represented the synagogue as this old declining woman, and the figure that represented the Christian church as a young, good, pretty girl, you know, showing that, you know, that this, that the Judaism was the older and the Christianity was the newer. And oh, they raised hell. They wanted to, but the library never took it down, but it didn't show it for years and years. You know, nobody could see it, but I think they can see it now.
It is all part of one mistaken program to prohibit free speech with reference to the Jew. It is utterly at one side of all that American principles mean. Shut him up, boycott him, tear down his painting, bar his words from the mails and public library. What a waste of energy, and what a self-judgment such an attitude has. And it has become pretty general. Last Christmas, most people had a hard time finding Christmas cards that indicated in any way that Christmas commemorates someone's birth. Easter, they will have the same difficulty in finding Easter cards that contain any suggestion that Easter commemorates a certain event. There will be rabbits and eggs and spring flowers, but a hint of the resurrection will be hard to find. Now, all this begins with the designers of the cards, and even in this business one comes upon that same policy of declaring anti-Semitic everything that is Christian. If Rabbi Coffey says the New Testament is the most anti-Semitic book ever written, what must be the judgment on an Easter card that is truly an Easter card? In November 1919, the Anti-Defamation Committee claimed that 150 American cities had excluded The Merchant of Venice from the public schools.
150?
Yeah.
Wow. No, that's a big number.
The newspapers at this writing are announcing that David Warfield, the great Jewish actor, is going to play Shylock in the manner which, as he believes, represents the true Shakespearean conception. The Anti-Defamation League may yet find itself to have expended much energy beating the wind, especially as the best Shakespearean critics declare that The Merchant of Venice is not about a Jew at all, but about usury, as a vicious practice which gripped both Jew and non-Jew, and brought division.
Well, you would think that they wouldn't accept that interpretation either, would you? Say it's not about a Jew, but about usury, which is practiced by the Jews and has been for a long, long time.
Yeah, they're certainly associated with it more than any other group.
Yeah.
But there was, however, a certain finesse in the manner of the Anti-Defamation League in approaching the matter of the exclusion of The Merchant. It was not an incapacity to appreciate the fine work of Shakespeare. Oh, no, anything but that. Nor was it a confession of thin-skinned sensibility on the part of Jews. Not at all. No, it was really for the benefit of the Gentile children that the Anti-Defamation League wanted them kept away from that play in their reading lessons.
Gentile children, I know. This is really classic how they wrote this thing.
Here are excerpts from one of the letters sent out from the Anti-Defamation League in Chicago to the superintendent of public schools in an important city. The italics are ours. Well, you can't hear italics. We have just been advised that the blankety blank high schools still retain The Merchant of Venice in the list of required readings. We do not base our request because of the embarrassment which may be caused to the Jewish students in the class, nor is our attitude in this regard based on thin-skinned sensitiveness. It is the result of mature consideration and investigation. Our objection is made because of its effect upon the non-Jewish children, who subconsciously will associate in their minds the Jew as Shakespeare portrayed him with the Jew of today. Children are not analysts. A character in the past vividly portrayed exists for them in the present. The Jew of Shakespeare lives in the mind of the child as the Jew of New York, or the Jew of Chicago, or the Jew of Newark. Your teachers of literature might say much in favor of Shylock's good qualities, but our experience has been that only very seldom are Shylock's good qualities brought out strongly before children. Those traits of his character which are brought out most vividly in the study of the play are Shylock's greed, hatred, revenge, and cruelty. The fact that the Chicago College Entrance Requirements Board realized the justice of our stand and struck the play off from the list as required readings for entrance to our universities and colleges indicates clearly that it is a most serious problem. We believe that when you realize the great harm which might be caused to hundreds and thousands of law-abiding Jewish citizens of this country, you will grant our request that the reading of The Merchant of Venice be discontinued from your schools.
God.
And in this case, it was. Notwithstanding the fact that the play was used in the high school, and the argument of the letter was addressed to the effect of the play on children, it was discontinued. A study of the schedule of just what occurred showed that everything had been made ready even before the letter was written. Does this frittering away of Jewish influence strike the Jewish leaders as a wise policy? Is there any hope whatever of doing away with the Merchant of Venice? Do they not know that it is the observation of teachers of literature that even if non-Jewish children are forbidden to read the play, Jewish children are going to read it anyway, since it is the Jewish children who most heartily enjoy it because they more clearly understand it? Do not the Jewish leaders know that non-Jews do not read The Merchant for Shylock, except perhaps his noble defense of the Jew as a human being? Whoever hears Shylock quoted in anything but this, which numerous Jewish readers delight to quote.
Jewish writers.
I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions?
Now, I don't think they'd allow that on a stage doing a Shakespeare play, Hatting, for the Shylock to talk that way. Remember, this is Shakespeare.
To effect its purpose, the Anti-Defamation League will have to perform an excision on our common English tongue. The wise and witty sayings of this Shakespearean play have passed into the permanent coinage of daily speech.
Okay, now these are a bunch of quotes that you're going to hear.
Yeah. I hold the world a stage where every man must play his part, and mine a sad one. That's Antonio from Merchants of Venice.
Oh.
I am Sir Oracle. Oh, he's not a Jew. Sorry. I am Sir Oracle, and when I ope my lips, let no dog bark. That's Gratiano.
Oh, aren't you smart?
I looked him up.
Oh, you looked him up. Good for you.
If to do were as easy as to know what were good to do, chapels had been churches, and poor men's cottages princes' palaces. The devil can cite scripture for his purpose.
Now that's one I've heard plenty. Who said that?
Antonio.
Okay.
A goodly apple rotten at the heart. Oh, what a goodly outside falsehood hath. Truth will come to sight. Murder cannot be hid long. This one is written by Portia, actually. You want to read that?
Oh, Portia, all that glitters is not gold.
And I think the rest of it is, too.
A harmless, necessary cat. Well, what is that supposed to mean? Why is that great? A harmless, necessary cat.
Go on.
Oh, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. And it is an attribute of God himself, and earthly power doth then show likest God's when mercy seasons justice. Well, those two went together. I messed that up.
This is beyond the power of the Anti-Defamation League to destroy. Shylock may be forgotten, but not these living lines. It is true, however, that in 150 American cities, according to the League's claim, school children are prevented from reading and hearing these words in school. But is it worth it? Is it a part of Jewish rites that an admittedly great play taught in all the English courses of all the universities should be prohibited to the children of the people in the public schools? From the prohibition of the Bible to the prohibition of Shakespeare, the whole Jewish course has been a colossal mistake, the reaction from which will be to belittle Jewish public judgment in the future. That should be quite belittled at this point.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is why we hate them so much, because they just, you know, they just prevent us from having all kinds of things that belong to us.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of criticism of Jews now, although you don't see it very much in mass media.
Right.
Mainstream mass media. It was all very well said by a correspondent to the Newark Evening News, January 13, 1920. To the editors of the news, sir, protests have been made by the representatives of the Jewish, Scotch, and colored races against Shakespeare's being used in the public schools. The former because of the portrayal of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. Some Scotch folk have protested, as I understand it, to the Newark Boards of Education on account of the matter of the character given Macbeth. The colored folks, judging from the letter printed in the news from Washington, do not like the character Othello, owing to his despicable treatment of Desdemona. As a descendant of the Welsh race, I enter my protest in behalf of that ancient people in regard to Shakespeare's ridicule in Henry V of the Welshman Captain Llewelyn, who is made to look as if he did not know anything about war. I have no doubt that others could find fault with Shakespeare's penchant for holding up the weak side of some of his characters, so I think that Shakespeare and the Bible might well be kept out of the public schools, because both books are rough on certain people whose identity is clearly known. The Board of Education is to be congratulated for taking action in the matter, which promises at this late date to place the Newark educational system in a class all by itself.
All righty, that is the end of this chapter, which came out 19th March 1921. You know, I felt at the end that letter at the end there that this man was so, were people smarter then than they are now? Because this letter was so kind of very ironic, but it's not real clear unless, you know, to somebody who's a little dense, that it's ironic, and they might take it seriously, you know.
Well,
but I think irony used to be more, people used to be more smart about it than we are now.
But, yeah, well, if you look at magazines from today as compared to just in the 1960s, you'll see a difference. Time magazine, for example, used to have much longer articles in smaller print. Mm-hmm. And today it's large print.
Oh, I haven't looked at one for a long time, but it's true. Today's magazines are just horrible. That's true. And if you would go all the way back to 1920s, then you see real stuff, you know, long articles, small print, and lots of seriousness, you know, and small pictures. Today it's all images and big print. Yeah, even the Barnes Review went to larger print. I don't want to criticize them, but they went to this large print, and that just shortens the articles and shortens the amount that there is to read in there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to increase the price of their magazine. Nobody will buy it, so then they do have to do things like that. But anyway, this is. Go ahead. What are you
going to
say?
I was just going to say that it reflects the decline in the literacy of readers. You know, they don't have the attention span for the long articles, and probably, you know, we've also seen a general decline in education. And this is something that's often discussed.
Exactly. Well, just today somebody read my article, and I told them to, and the first thing he said was that maybe I had my first sentence in the first paragraph, my sentence was too long, and that he didn't think it was too long, but that some people might have trouble, you know, following a long sentence, although there was a big dash in between, so they shouldn't. And I looked at it, but I didn't want to change it. But it's true, you know, if you're going to start catering to this, you know, you're going to just bring everything down. And I think what we want to do is bring our people up, not bring ourselves down. But yeah, this is, you know, I don't understand some of this Shakespeare here. Why is it that she said a harmless, necessary cat? Why is that famous?
I don't know. I think you'd have to know the context.
Yeah, I'm afraid, you know, I really never read. Probably that was maybe it was banned from my school, but I never really read Merchant of Venice, mm-hmm. even though it's one of the more popular ones. So.
Well, I think it's not very often read these days.
Hmm. Well, they drove it out. Let's see. There are some other things about this show we can talk about. Plus, I was looking at my emails, and there's a lot of, all of a sudden I got a bunch of emails, but nothing that is about this show. But somebody wrote me, who are the true Semites? Oh, this is another one of these telling me what
the Bible true Semites means. Are people that speak Semitic languages.
Okay.
Semitic is a language group, first and foremost.
Speak about that. But there was, well, we have a little time to discuss this, or even earlier ones. And let me see what I can find that I'd like to discuss. Somebody could call in.
Well, trying to find out the meaning of harmless, necessary cat.
Okay. Okay, the B'nai B'rith, you know, they seem to think it was not such a bad organization. But today, it is. It still is the sponsor of the Anti-Defamation League, which has always been, as they said, that is the militant arm of their organization.
So, yeah, I think the reason why Ford said that he thought that the B'nai B'rith offered some hope of being an agency for reconciliation and so forth is because of its Masonic character. I think that's the reason.
Oh, yeah, we didn't have as much time as I thought we did. You keep bringing up Ford's Masonry. You think he was really serious about that, about the real meanings of it and all? See, I tend to want to think he just joined it at some point. Everybody was joining, and he didn't really get, you know, close or follow the policies or anything that much.
Well, you know, what you read in his comments about trying to make reason prevail are consistent with what Albert Pike wrote in Morals and Dogma. That's,
yeah, but a lot of people believe that. They didn't have to be in Masonry. But that's what I mean. At that time, that kind of thinking was very current and popular, wouldn't you say?
Well,
you know, in general, you know, progressiveness and so on. We've run out of time. All right, we don't have an answer for that quite, but thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and come back with us next week.
I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.